We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. On today's episode, we're talking with Dr. Elliot Borenstein about Harry Potter in Russia. I'm Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2, and co-editor with Emily Strand of Potterversity, essays exploring the world of Harry Potter.
And I am Emily Strand, Director of Campus Ministry and Humanities Faculty at Ohio Dominican University. And I also co-edited that book Katie just named and a couple others for Vernon Press on Star Wars and Star Trek. It's different every time.
I have my little spiel, and Emily, you like to mix it up. That's all good.
I do.
Yeah, you got a lot of good things to mention also in your bio of sci-fi fantasy scholarship.
Nerdery.
We are going to be talking today with Dr. Elliot Borenstein about Harry Potter in Russia. And one of the topics in his really fascinating book is the moral panic in Russia over the Potter books. So there's a moral panic in Russia when the books really become popular, and it reminded me of the Potter panic that happened in the United States in the early 2000s over whether the Harry Potter books are demonic or satanic in some fashion. Emily, what are your conclusions, or what do you think about that early Potter panic?
I think it's so interesting to move from a perspective of kind of dealing with it head on and it being like a constant reality in my world, because I do operate in religious circles, to then looking at it sort of retrospectively. Now it has really cooled. And I don't necessarily think that kind of moral opposition to a cultural product has necessarily cooled. But I think that the fervor over Harry Potter as the focus has definitely cooled. And sometimes I even wonder, and I'm just workshopping this, but sometimes I even wonder if her kind of innate, more conservative ideology, you know, in terms of transgenderism, things like that, that has been kind of unveiled in the last few years, I wonder if that has helped to kind of snuff it out completely. Because people are seeing the works as, in fact, more conservative than they first assessed them, and that they have an inherent, you know, kind of a conservatism that people didn't really recognize when they were, you know, first coming out.
You know, I think there's kind of a reflect in some religious circles in the United States, there's a reflexive rejection of witches, you know, just sort of sorcery. Yeah. You're not supposed to do that. And every now and again, you know, there was that school in Nashville not too long ago that banned the books.
Yes.
Because they thought the students would actually make magic from the spell.
The pastor banned the books. I actually wrote about that on my blog, folks. I did a little response. This pastor seemed a little unclear as to the fact that the spells are fictional and that the magic in the books are fictional. It was a little strange. I was kind of like, hey, diocesan officials, somebody get an eye on this guy.
Come on. Well, what I think is interesting is that in some ways, the religious panic takes the magic a little more seriously as potentially real, and that it can have an influence in a way that I think some of the people who are drawn to it and like it don't even really believe. And so I think it's sort of interesting, right, as a kind of matter of faith. But I also really appreciate what you said about, I do think there has been a little reversal. Like if the liberals have turned against J.K. Rowling, maybe she's good after all, you know. They're sort of, we're so polarized, you know, the enemy of my enemy might be my friend after all. So,
right.
I don't know. I find that very sad, of course.
Yeah, I do too. But I have to say, it's nice not to get letters. So I don't get any letters anymore from people with really, you know, really beautiful cursive handwriting. This just doesn't happen. Telling me that I should stop what I'm doing. And so I'm okay with that part.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it's interesting because in Russia, you have the, you know, the moral religious panic. That's a lot of it coming from the Russian Orthodox Church that's been restored to a position of prominence since the fall of the Soviet Union. But then also there is a significant amount of homophobia and suppression of LGBTQ individuals in Russia. And so that's a kind of interesting confluence that I'm interested to see. Maybe our discussion will probe that a little bit more deeply. Well, without any further ado, let me introduce our guest today. In this episode, we are joined by Dr. Elliot Borenstein, professor of Russian and Slavic Studies and vice chancellor and vice provost of global programs at New York University. He's the author of numerous books about modern and post-Soviet Russia, particularly focusing on literature, politics, and popular culture. The book we're focusing on today is his most recent work, which is The Politics of Fantasy: Magic, Children's Literature, and Fandom in Putin's Russia, published by University of Wisconsin Press in 2025. There is so much in this book about Harry Potter and Russia, and I think our conversation's only going to be able to just touch the surface, but I can't wait to talk more with Dr. Borenstein about this. Welcome to the show, Elliot.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted.
So Elliot was the keynote speaker at the Harry Potter Academic Conference in the fall of 2025, and Emily and I both heard his talk. And Elliot, I have to tell you, so it was a virtual year. I teach at the noon hour, and your talk was during a test that I had scheduled, and I couldn't find anybody to proctor it for me. So I had my earbuds in while I was proctoring the test, and I kept having to cover my mouth because I was laughing so hard. I know the students were like, what is she doing over there? And I remember typing in my questions and comments in the chat, and it was so fascinating, so interesting, and I'm so glad to have you on the show. So let's just go right ahead and get started and go back a little ways here. Elliot, when did you first encounter the Harry Potter stories, and when did you decide they were worthy of academic study?
Well, I first encountered the Harry Potter stories in a way that I think is typical of my demographic. I'm turning 60 this year. So I read a New York Times article about the forthcoming Goblet of Fire and how people are lining up and how adults are reading it. And since I do read fantasy and science fiction as my main pleasure reading, I thought I'll take a look at it. And so we got the copy. My wife and I read it. This was before we had any kids, a couple years before we had any kids, and we're totally into it. So at the time, it was just another thing I was reading. And then a few things happened. One, I ended up around 2002, I stopped reading on paper completely. I never read anything on paper. And so I would be always looking for ebooks, for frankly pirated ebooks. And when the fifth book came out, we immediately ordered a copy. My wife's reading it, everybody's reading it, and I'm just online on LimeWire, if you remember LimeWire, desperately looking for anything, most likely a PDF of Order of Phoenix. And I found it, and I downloaded it, and I marked it up. It took me a while so I could read it as a reflowable ebook, and it was terrible. It was so bad. It was poorly written. The grammar was bad. The characterization was terrible. Everybody was learning how to be an animagus, and someone was going to become the dreaded Polymagus. And the Order of Phoenix turned out to be a spell to bring Lily Potter back to life. And I've been told that Sirius Black dies, but actually Hermione dies. And as I'm reading this, A.S. Byatt publishes this editorial in the Times saying, you know, it's adults shouldn't be reading this trash. And I read, and I was so annoyed by it. And I love A.S. Byatt, but I hate that sort of attitude. But I was reading, thinking, God, maybe she's right. I'm wasting my time on this. And so I got through it and I caught up a friend and I said, look, you told me that Sirius Black died and it was actually Hermione. And this book is everything. What are you talking about? And I had spent all this time reading 500 pages of really bad fan fiction. You know, Cho Chang was blonde, like, all this stuff. Really, really terrible fan fiction without realizing it. And so then I got the book and love. Actually, it's still my favorite book, the fifth one.
Oh, it's good. It's so political, too.
It's got to be a relief.
It is. But in the back of my head, I still have this phantom version in a different way from reading fan fiction, because I took it as canon, with these other things that almost happened. Then it intersected with my work when there were these reports that the Russian parliament wanted to sue Warner Brothers because Dobby looked like Putin.
Gosh, classic. I love it.
I thought that was in my head. I'm so glad to hear it's a thing.
But the funny thing about it is that, I argue that it couldn't have been intentional, because by the time Putin was barely in power by the time they were doing all this, he does look like him. But I had to say that. So I'm a Russian studies person. My wife's a Russian studies person. All these Russian studies people who watch Harry Potter, none of us saw Putin, right? So if we didn't see Putin, it seemed really unlikely to me that it was definitely Putin, because we're kind of primed to see Putin everywhere, unfortunately. So that made it into one of my books. And then I just started noticing more and more stuff about the responses to Harry Potter, and I kept filing things away, thinking they would fit into some book or another. Because I'm always basically, I get material, I think maybe this will be a chapter in something, maybe it'll be here, and I use a little bit of it and I keep it, and then hope that it'll become something. Eventually, when Putin made some comment defending J.K. Rowling on trans stuff, and J.K. Rowling basically said, "I don't want your defense, thank you," because as bad as she is, she's not that bad, right? So, that might be a controversial statement, but I do think Putin is worse. So I wrote a little op-ed about it, and then I ended up giving a talk, and then I realized I have a book. So, because I had all this stuff, and I wrote the book rather quickly because I'd been assembling a fair amount of material, and it was loads of fun. And I was going to publish it with Bloomsbury, her publisher, and then their lawyers got involved, and I couldn't publish with them because they wanted me to make too many changes, because they were afraid of the libel laws in the UK. So I had to bring it to my wonderful press, University of Wisconsin Press, which still their lawyers didn't let me use the Harry Potter in the title either, which surprised. I said there's so many books with Harry Potter in the title, but fine. So that was a very long meandering way to say how I got into this topic.
No, that's great. And I shamelessly pilfered Harry Potter in Russia as the title of this podcast because I thought, like you said, like it's so clearly like that is what the book is about, you know, the whole experience of it and the experience of the canonical texts and then the movies, but then also all the things that people are doing with Harry Potter in Russia. It's just super fascinating. And
It
there's
is.
so much. I don't know. There's so many places to go with it. And it looks like things are even still being produced and everything. There's a lot that's still going on. I always think about like trying to explain this to students that academics, we do focus a lot, but especially like when you're doing culture studies and so on, like as not, there's an intersection in almost everything, and the sci-fi or fantasy Russia and then the Harry Potter Russia, like totally on topic for you.
Spending time with your book over the last week and then also re-listening to your Chestnut Hill talk, which folks, by the way, anybody can listen to. It's on the Harry Potter Academic Conference YouTube channel. And you'll find it there with many of the other wonderful talks from this past year's conference and some older talks as well. After spending time with your thinking about Harry Potter in Russia, I was really in that world. You know, my mind was kind of trying, I was starting to be able to kind of follow, okay, well, yeah, that's logical for the kind of cultural landscape that you're talking about. So let's get into it. When was Harry Potter introduced in the Russian Federation, and how was it initially received?
Okay, so one of the things that I really like about the Harry Potter franchise as a way of getting into Russia's appropriation or evaluation of foreign popular culture is that this is the first time that a huge Western mega franchise comes to Russia without a huge delay. I talk about how Star Wars and Lord of the Rings had a significant delay, and there was an underground following, and they'd hear about it before they saw it. So there's a bit of catching up going on, and the way Russians interpret those two sets of texts is also fascinating, but not what we're talking about today. But with Harry Potter, there was a translator who translated Douglas Adams, and a friend said, "I think you'll like this book." And so she translated the first book or two and published them online around 2000. And then a press got the rights. The upshot is that the books start to appear not too long after 2000. And if you figure that the first three books, they did well, but I don't think it was as huge a phenomenon until book four. That's not much of a lag. And then from then on, it's like with every other country, the translations appear as soon as possible after the original. The films appear basically at the same time. So with a delay that I think means almost nothing, frankly, this became something that was simultaneous in Russia and the rest of the world. And that was really new.
for our listeners who are not maybe so familiar with the trajectory of Russian history, you know, when you think about how you had during the Cold War, it was culture wars, essentially, between Soviet-style communism and liberal capitalism of the United States. I guess the communist world, especially in the Soviet Union and its satellite states, it was very careful to guard against Western culture and Western media. And so you have this underground that develops because culture seeps in, right? If it's attractive, people will find their ways to it. But that it there was an official culture, and that the other kind of Western culture became even like a source of potential rebellion or subversion. But then when the Cold War is over, especially in like 1991 through to 2000, you know, you have this opening up and you have people exploring, I would say, like wildly in a way, right? This more broader culture, especially coming from the West. And then to see the Harry Potter juggernaut, as you say, come in as a global phenomenon that Russia can experience in real time. I mean, I just think that's such a really interesting, an interesting event. But you also say that the books are really in Russia. They are bounded by the era of Vladimir Putin. Why do you think the Harry Potter books then became such a cultural touch point in Russia?
Well, first off, Katie, thank you so much for providing the context that I really should have provided, and you did it.
Oh, no problem.
No, you really did, because I should have. I take for granted that people know that, you know, most of Western culture wasn't really accessible during the Soviet times, and only in the late 80s did more of it come through. And the 1990s is just inundated with Western popular crap of the lowest order, and some good stuff.
Baywatch.
Baywatch. Oh, Baywatch. Yeah, no. Santa Barbara, Santa Barbara, and really bad sitcoms. And one thing that is interesting is when they start getting some of the better stuff. That becomes a problem after 1998 when the economy is collapsing. That's what actually stimulates Russia to produce more of its own stuff because it's cheaper. But eventually they start watching the good stuff and reading the good stuff. But as for Harry Potter, I mean, it is just a coincidence that Harry Potter is a Putin-era phenomenon. I mean, I love it. It works perfectly for that. But it just so happens that that's how it works. But also, I think as in the rest of the world, Harry Potter becomes an interesting touchstone because multiple generations are reading it. And not just that, but because so much time has passed that the people who read it as kids and teenagers when it came out are, you know, adults reading it to their kids. So these become these points of reference. And, you know, in the Soviet Union, there was a whole set of points of reference that everybody used all the time from Soviet culture and cartoons and all that. And it was great. And it was opaque to outsiders because unless you studied the country, you didn't really know much about it. Just as, you know, my generation, we could talk about the commercials we saw in the 1970s. And if you didn't see them, you don't know what you're talking about. But Harry Potter then just like, you know, Lord of the Rings and Star Wars, just a wonderful source of metaphors and images that you can apply everywhere. But what's happening here is this is a Western source, and it's this weird combination of British, which is good because they love British culture over there, and American Hollywood, which is bad. It makes people anxious. And it also made people anxious because, what I remember about when kids were reading lots of Harry Potter and people writing about it, one of the first things people were saying is, you know, even if they didn't like it, all right? And I know people who read the first book and said, it's not so great. It's like, yeah, actually, the first book isn't written as well as the others, really. I mean, it's fine, but by book four, she's really firing on all cylinders. What people would say is, I'm just so glad my kids are reading. My kids are reading these 600, 700-page novels instead of just playing video games. And because in the West, we'd had so many years of panic over falling reading rates, people were able to look at this like, I don't care what it is. I'm just glad they're reading. Whereas in the Soviet Union always, people were always proud of being the translation would be the readingest country on earth, that more people read in the Soviet Union than anywhere. And I believe it was true. And then in the 90s, people were still reading because all of this trash literature that came out was really accessible and cheap. But eventually, of course, younger generations are reading less. But they weren't quite at that point where they could say, I'm just glad they're reading anything. It's like, why aren't they reading the classics? Why aren't aren't they reading the stuff we were reading? Because the other thing that happens is that in America, at least, we're used to the idea that each generation has its own children's books that they come to. Yes, of course, everybody reads Dr. Seuss, right? And we want them all to read Dr. Seuss, but there's going to be a new franchise. You know, some people grew up reading Magic Tree House or Animorphs, but no one nowadays, I think, reads those. There's a Babysitter Club, Come Back, all of those things. But we're used to the idea that there's going to be perennials and there's going to be new stuff. But for decades, for the most part, children are reading the same stuff their parents and grandparents read. And if you think about it, that makes sense. Children are disposable consumers. They don't necessarily need a new children's book because you just have a new kid.
It's new to them anyway.
It's new to them anyway, right? So, like, you know, I was like, why are you making new episodes of Sesame Street? You have 50 of them, just keep showing them. I mean, I'm glad they do. That was not the attitude. So the idea that these kids are reading and watching these things that are alien to you and weren't part of your childhood is a little more off-putting than it is here. I compare it to in the 90s when Pokemon hit the US and anime hit and all these parents like, what is this stuff? What is a Pokemon? What is all this stuff, right? That is one of the few moments when in America we had that kind of foreign cultural invasion that confused people. Russia was getting it all the time. So Harry Potter becomes a big touchstone for that.
Yes, that makes sense. Like I think Pokemon is a great example because I did not get that, or the Digimon, or it's like,
yeah, exactly.
But it's a whole, like, my kids were, and it was like a language that they were able to speak. I would say still able to speak, that I just don't have. And I remember thinking, why can't they be memorizing dinosaurs or something, like something real?
The fact that they're still speaking it comes back to what I was saying about Harry Potter, right? Because those are the memes that become the culture of an entire generation. Harry Potter is like that too. Muggles, you know, Death Eaters, the letter to Hogwarts, right? We all know these things.
You discuss the kind of ways that Harry Potter is, you know, kind of coming into Russian culture. And you talk about it both in terms of the content of the stories and also Harry Potter as a global transmedia phenomenon. And so I thought it would be a good idea to take those one by one, because it can be easy to confuse those a little bit, which I think is sort of at the center of your, you know, when you were talking about accidentally reading a fan fiction of Order of the Phoenix, sort of that's the global transmedia part of it. But what is it about the contents of the stories that has helped the wizarding world to be appealing to Russians? And even, I would say, not just appealing, but on the other side, panic inducing.
Yeah, provocative.
So I think part of it is just that it's a really good set of stories about children having magical experiences. So I hesitate to use the word universal because it's, you know, we can never prove it, and culture, and there are obviously huge cultural differences. But Harry Potter is like a well-oiled machine to deliver a certain types of pleasures to kids. That's not a criticism. That's just my description of it. I would think, you know, there'd have to be something so different about Russia and Russian life for kids not to like it, right? Then there's some cultural questions about, like, the whole happy end phenomenon and the lone wolf or a small group of people who can conquer evil. That is a very Anglo-American framework. But again, also these kids are watching all sorts of Anglo-American products and Anglo-American influence products. So that's not necessarily alien. I just think, you know, despite my really negative feelings about J.K. Rowling as a person in the past several years, she did a really good job creating this world that people are still very happy to immerse themselves in. So it's not a surprise to me that it worked in Russia.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And that's one of the criticisms was it's derivative or whatever. And yes. I mean, I think all the good stuff is derivative of something. And so I think that's actually part of its strength, is that it hits, yes, like you say, some things that are always, you know, children always like some of these kinds of stories where the kids are the ones figuring everything out and they actually have some power to do things. And the content of the Harry Potter books also produced a kind of Potter panic in Russia. And that's where I started with the question to Emily about the U.S. Potter panic. And it struck me that there are some real similarities in the Russian Potter panic that hits in the 2000s.
Yeah, definitely. And by the way, I agree that the Potter panic here has leveled off. And I think it's because they're so focused on queerness and transgender, and there isn't really that much of it in the text, right? So they're doing things like pointing to books like Genderqueer and banning those sort of things. They're just so much more worried about that that they've moved on. Also, Harry Potter's old news. But in Russia, different context, of course. And one big thing is that Russia did not go through, the Soviet Union did not go through the Satanic Panic of the 1980s. And of course they didn't. It was officially an atheist country. I mean, yes, you had churches and all of that, but you did not have the confluence of institutions that you need for moral panic, which are so-called experts, concerned parents, and the media all coming together to say, this is a problem. And we've seen it again and again in the West. We've seen it with comic books. We've seen it with juvenile delinquency. We've seen it with rock lyrics. But in the 80s, with the Satanic Panic, I mean, I remember at the time, I was like, I can't believe people believe this nonsense. But they did. With the 80s, you have the I think in part with the growing influence of the evangelical world, and this general sense of children in danger, this belief that Satanists out there are actually kidnapping and abusing children with leaving no trace whatsoever. That's a whole other thing. That just did not make it into the Soviet Union. So, good for them, frankly, for that. But what you have in the 90s, of course, is this explosion of religious activity with all sorts of missionaries coming to the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, and new religious movements, what we call cults, the Hare Krishna, Scientologists, all these people, Mormons in big numbers. And this led to a huge backlash. The Russian Orthodox Church, one of their attitudes is like, you're acting like we're a heathen country. We are a Christian country. What are you doing sending Christian missionaries and trying to poach our Christian souls? And then there are laws passed starting late 1990s to restrict all sorts of religious activity, fine, whatever. But meanwhile, you have the growth of the influence of the Russian Orthodox Church, which, by the way, is not just officials of the church by any means. It's activists who are speaking out in the name of orthodoxy. They might not actually be affiliated with the church or speak on behalf of the church. I want to say that because it's a fuzzy thing. If you also take into account the persistence of kind of popular low magic religiosity, belief in psychics and clairvoyance and all of that, and curses and things like that, it's all there. People aligned with this particular version of orthodoxy are patrolling, basically patrolling the lines of sin and trying to keep the devil out, right? And so they're seeing things demonic just about everywhere. And that is an example of how, yes, religious people can take this notion of these spells really seriously, because for people like me, the devil isn't real. I mean, I'm an atheist. The God for me isn't real either. So you can talk about the devil, it just doesn't matter. But if you believe the devil is this real phenomenon that actually exerts power on it, then invoking the devil and having things that look like the devil are a problem. And then, of course, there's a long-standing Christian tradition of talking about anything that is magic or pagan or animist and calling it satanic, right? Or misapplying the term. And then there you have it, right? So, because it's about children, because it's about magic, which was not, there were magic stories in Soviet time, but not so much. This becomes something that that certain people, conservative people connected with orthodoxy, would really latch on to. So one other important thing about the fight against Harry Potter is that it's very connected with the fight against Halloween. There's no reason to expect that Halloween should be celebrated around the world. It's a like a local phenomenon. I'm not going to go into all the roots of it, but over the years it has drifted to other countries. You can chalk it up to the might of American marketing, all that, and also that Halloween is really fun. But Halloween is also really weird. One, if you have a kind of if you have a religious point of view where you think of where you do think magic is dangerous and connected to the satanic, then dressing up as monsters and all of that is really a problem. And then also it's kids are going around basically extorting neighbors for candy and threatening them. If you look at it from the outside, it's not necessarily so appealing. But I grew up with my parents checking all the candy for razor blades. And it never happened, but we all had that stuff, right? So people start doing Halloween in Russia because it's fun, whatever. And people associated with the church are freaking out. What is this? One, it's American, which is already bad. And two, all the things that I've already talked about. And that is also that starts in the 90s, but it's really picking up around the same time as Harry Potter. So the two are discussed together as phenomena of Western Satanism infiltrating Russia. It doesn't help Harry Potter and it doesn't help Halloween. And there are all these attempts by various people to try to get courts to block Harry Potter and to forbid Halloween, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But it's a strange thing because in the West, I mean, I know this happens in Catholic countries, but I associate this kind of approach to fears of Satanism as being more of an evangelical Protestant thing than as a Catholic thing. And in Russia, they just have not had this long tradition of of a church publicly policing things as possibly being satanic. Now they do, but I'm not sure how well that really takes hold of people's minds, because while many more people say they're Orthodox nowadays, that doesn't mean they go to church. That doesn't, and there's also not one of the things that I think is fascinating about being Christian and not being Protestant is, and tell me if I'm getting this wrong, but there isn't the expectation of this complete consistency between your deeds, your thoughts, and what you profess to believe. There's a lot of room for maneuvering that you might not have if you're a hardcore evangelical. So people could nod and say, yeah, I hear you, oh, it's bad, and then go and read Harry Potter. Just like they nodded about everything the Soviets said, and then they went off and, bought jeans and listened to rock music.
Right.
So,
Beatles.
there's in general a tradition of dealing with authority of just sort of superficially complying or not resisting and then just ignoring it. What I mean is I don't know how many people really care that people associated with the church say it's satanic.
I think part of that difference that you see between Catholics or Orthodox and more evangelicals is that Catholics and Orthodox, we have rituals to counteract these things that you're talking about. So first of all, we have confession, we have reconciliation, where we if we do something that's against our creed, then we can go and wash in the waters beneath, Mandalore, sort of thing. But then, we also, and I'm sure our audience will get that completely. But we also have exorcism. I mean, we have rites and prayers and rituals that go along with warding off evil. And I think that gives us more of a security in the world. If I can, I don't know, maybe I'm totally wrong, but I do think my area of expertise is liturgy. So I'm like, I think rituals solve everything, for humans. And so I think that mindset is maybe affected by that
I think
reality.
basically you have professionals to handle
We do. We absolutely do.
I
And
know.
it's funny how often. I was at the University of Dayton for 7 years in campus ministry, which is a very large place, 10,000 students. And so we had a priest on call. And, I'm not saying he was getting calls to give room blessings every night, but he was getting them once a semester, once a school year, for sure. For somebody who felt uncomfortable in their room and felt like there was a dark energy and wanted the church to come in, literally, this little bald priest come into their room and exercise whatever dark forces are there. So yeah, it is
I
very
burn
interesting.
sage sometimes. I'm a
Yeah.
Unitarian Universalist, Elliot, so
So there you
I
go.
like all the stuff. I'll do
I like
whatever.
that. I
It's
like
sort of
that.
like, you get your teeth cleaned every 6 months, right? And you get your cavities taken care of. I think the exact analogy is flossing. Like, you should be
Yes.
flossing and you're not flossing. And when you go in, you're going to be told, oh, you should be flossing.
You're getting away with it, though.
You're getting away
But
with it,
there's an
right?
expert
Because
who'll
there's
fix it
still
all up.
floor. There's expert and there's still fluoride in the water so far. So we're good.
So, Elliot, basically, like when Katie and I were talking at the beginning about how, the Potter panic here has really waned, but you see that this is an ongoing conversation
Less. I mean,
in the Russian Federation.
in the panic, it's less. And in fact, I cite some study that shows that the Orthodox side of the panic started to fade somewhere in the middle of the teens, and then it became more of a queer panic thing. But ultimately, I think people moved on, right? So you gave up. It starts just being part of the background. And there's some other satanic thing to fight.
I feel like that's kind of a pop culture thing, right? Because
Exactly.
it can go pretty quickly. But one of the things I was really interested in was that you were talking about how, Russia didn't have this like for the children, protect the children kind of mentality because they had other ways of enforcing official authority and, this is what's the prescribed correct culture or the correct set of beliefs, but that this for the children was a way to enforce that. And you could, the Harry Potter stories kind of got in the middle of that. But also, it struck me something kind of similar to what we experience in the United States is conspiracy theory culture. And I think you can see that in the Potter panic of in Russia, particularly. But of course, those conspiracy theories, like that there's a conspiracy to do X. And I was thinking about also how you said, there's this conspiracy theory, I guess, sort of that Dobby was intentionally made to look like Vladimir Putin.
Right. If you have a truly conspiratorial mindset, and I did work on this for quite a while, there's nothing happens by chance. And that is something that can be optimistic. Like when people say to everything happens for a reason, I want to smack them, but I understand why people say that. But everything happens for a reason. The flip side of it is everything's happening for a reason, and you have to find out who the evil people are who are doing this. And so, this is a sort of paranoid epistemology that, for one thing, the Soviet Union certainly encouraged by releasing so little information, that what I argue is that in the absence of reliable information, conspiracy theories just flourished because you're not being told the whole truth, so you fill it in. It also works when you have too much information, like we have now. So almost anything can give you conspiracy theory. But yes, absolutely. That is where the Harry Potter panic fits in with what starts to become mainstream Russian media culture, which is in fact conspiratorial. It went from the sidelines to the mainstream by certainly by Putin's third term, that is when he came back in 2012, with the constant reference to the West trying to bring us down. The West brought down the Soviet Union. Gorbachev was an agent of the CIA. The West wants to is looking ahead to it to an ecological disaster when the only place on Earth to live will be in Siberia, and so they want Siberia. I mean, absolutely everything. So why not Harry Potter?
So, what was so appealing versus concerning about the form of the phenomenon, now that we've talked about the content, in not only the books and the movies, but also fandom, such as fan groups, fan fiction, digital fan productions, knockoffs, etc.?
Well, in a sense, some of what's appealing was also what was frightening, because something that starts in the 90s is this notion of not just literature, but a project that is coming up with a franchise, noticing that there are Western franchises, maybe we can do this too, we can have series, and the concern that this is bringing down quality. So there was already an association between something being considered a project, and Harry Potter was considered a project, low quality. So that's coming in. But actually, I think it's pretty high quality and it works pretty well. Between that and the fact that it is both books and movies, you're really getting people from just about all angles. So this is something that a lot of cultural producers in Russia have wanted to do on their own and have had very limited success in that kind of transmedia phenomenon, more and more lately, but certainly by the time at the time we're talking about, very, very little that really worked that way. So some of it is frustration that we're still not doing it right. But then there's the fandom. Fandom had existed even in the Soviet Union a bit, and certainly afterwards. And a lot of it was around the things that you would expect to find it in science fiction and fantasy, certainly. Twin Peaks in the 1990s was a huge thing. X-Files, all of this stuff. The very first fan fiction I ever saw in Russian was a 5-volume alternate universe saga of Babylon 5, that is over 1 million words long and translated into Russian from English. You can read it. I made my way through 2 books of it. I really tried hard, and I'm a big Babylon 5 fan. In a sense, the funny thing about fan fiction is kind of like samizdat. Samizdat was the illegal self-publishing back when a lot of things weren't allowed to publish in the Soviet Union. Samizdat just means self-publishing. That's all it means. And in fact, one of the biggest fan fiction websites in Russia is called samizdat, because that's what they're doing. But I think most of the samizdat in Soviet times was actually about not fan fiction, but fiction and other things that couldn't get produced anywhere. But you already have the infrastructure and the sense of it. I don't know when fan fiction really starts in Russia. There was a wonderful scholar, Natalia Samutina, who did some great stuff on fan fiction. She died several years ago, but I love her work, and I don't remember what she identified as the earliest fan fiction. But anyway, a lot of fan fiction gets translated into Russian, which really surprised me. Just as it surprised me that most romance fiction in the 1990s, romance novels, they were almost all translated. Like, really? You're bothering to translate? But yeah, there's a whole reason why. Anyway, by the time of the 2000s, you do have more and more fan fiction coming up. And then the fandoms that come up around Harry Potter, what really struck me when I actually started going through the fan fiction, going online, looking at the fan community, was how, if we're not talking about video stuff, I'll talk about video in a minute, how very similar it was to the fan communities I'm familiar with in the West, and how wonderful that was in that it's, largely female slash queer slash female identified, that is very literal, heterosis male. Identifiably as a segment of it, and as a space where queer desire and women's desire and all the things that are wonderful about and tolerance, which is a bad word in Russian nowadays, basically, all of that is there. So the lack of difference, I thought, was really kind of nice. I mean, I normally want to find difference, and I think there should be difference. It's not like everything should be the same, but the ways in which it's the same was really, really encouraging. It's a place for women and queer people, girls to express themselves. On video, on the other hand, on YouTube, it's bros. It's fan subbing. Some of it's funny, but a lot of it's homophobic. A lot of it's racist. A lot of it's like two guys sitting around, joking with each other. And it's like a totally different world. I mean, if I kept going, I'd probably find some, but there just isn't that much overlap. Because this is coming out of a different tradition in Russia of fan subbing, of parodic fan subbing that starts with the series of humorous voice subs for the Lord of the Ring movies and renaming them and having them be about gang fights instead of about elves and all of that. And they're really funny. And they're called goblin translations. The guy who did this, he had the nickname Goblin. And that becomes its whole genre of everybody doing goblin translations. There are only like six official goblin translations, but it's a whole thing.
So
And
they
so
take, I'm sorry, just to help me understand. So they take the actual film and they just take the sound away and they add their
own dialogue, yes.
own dialogue. And so,
Yes,
yes.
Woody Allen did this in this wonderful film, What's Up, Tiger Lily, where he took this trashy, like Hong Kong movie and just made his own dialogue. It's hilarious. And that's what they're doing here. And it's very, very funny, but it's very bro-y. And it comes out, it's a culture of a bunch of guys sitting around, right? Not that there's anything wrong. Well, there can be, but it doesn't have to be. But it is very much that. And so most of it is more guys, and it's just more of a guy thing. And it just feels completely different. Some of it is really funny. And some of it is interesting, and a lot of it's offensive, but it's just a completely different vibe from the fan fiction circles.
And do you have any thoughts on why that divide?
I think the source, right? I think there is a phenomenon on the English language internet of like doing your own dialogue for a clip and all that, and or for a still panel from comics, for instance, that's done. But I think because of when the Goblin translations came out, they became so much more of an identifiable thing than it is in the West. And then just who it was, right? These were techie people who spoke English, and these were mostly guys, and that's just where it goes from. Whereas I think the people who started fan fiction probably saw Western fan fiction and found it appealing and did their own stuff in Russian. What I
And
guess
you're
was
right, there's that technical barrier to video production.
there is, though. I mean, there's actually traditionally there's been much less of the technological sexism that America always had, like, oh, girls don't do math and all that. Soviet women did all this stuff, but it is a very homosocial community, and it also that's the community that is really does come out of something specifically Russian, whereas the fan fiction thing is more international.
Yeah, so that's what I was going to ask next. I mean, you were talking about some of the things that are in common. With the fan communities in Russia, in terms of engaging with this wider global fan community. But what are some of the things that you think are distinctively Russian? How are Russians using fan fiction to say Russian things or things that feel, important in terms of the tensions or the hopes that they have for their own society?
I obviously haven't read all of Russian fan fiction, and in
Well,
fact,
right, I'm sure.
the real challenge is figuring out which ones you should be reading, right? I mean, like, I could have missed a lot of really important stuff, but I did start looking for things that were about Russia with Russian content. In Rowling's, what is that book? Not Magical Beast, but she has that one little book about like the Wizarding World, the sort of nonfiction, like a guide where
Is it,
she
oh, a Fantastic Beast and Where to Find Them? That
is
the
it
little
the
textbook?
little textbook,
There's
and
a
so you find
Quidditch
out
Through
about.
the Ages as
Oh no,
well.
it is fantastic. Yeah. No, it's a Fantastic Beast, just not like the movies. And you find out about like wizarding schools in different places. And Russia has this place called the Dostoyevsk, which is almost Russian, almost right. And anyway, so people started setting things there. People started focusing on the Bulgarian guy from book four. And there's this like one Russian family, and people fixate on it and fill that in. But for the most part, it's just like here are the Russians. Whereas the videos, a lot of it is about like, what if Harry Potter were in Russia? And then it's usually about like how terrible our living conditions are, or they wouldn't be able to handle this, or like a lot of satirical things. Like at one point, Snape is asking everybody in the class to get money from their families to purchase new drapes, which is like this whole almost scam that was happening in schools at the time in Russia. And so and it's totally, if you were watching this, even if you spoke Russian, you're thinking, well, why are they saying this? And it turns out there's a reason, right? So there's a lot of satire that's going on in those videos, which makes it kind of fun. But in the fan fiction, I just didn't see that much that was that difference. What you had is that wonderful ethos of acceptance that I really like on A3 and all that stuff.
There are also the knockoffs. Like I remember you talking about Tanya Grodder.
Yes. Tanya Grotter,
And
yeah.
so, and then you had also talked about how the government tries to get into this world of Harry Potter, but sort of turning it on its head,
Yeah.
which I think is sort of interesting when the government is like, we'll take this thing that, is popular and the kids are all doing it, and we'll use it to enforce our own authority and to tell
Yeah.
them that they're on the wrong side of things if they're rebelling.
Well, it's people associated with the government, but yeah, absolutely. So Tanya Grotter starts out there. So of course people do knockoffs. I mean, there's plenty of parodic knockoffs in the West. Like you go on Amazon, you can see all these stupid little parodies, and then there are people trying to do actual like series that aren't obvious ripoffs of Harry Potter, but doing kind of the same thing, so they can, you know, have their own world. And so then the parody ones, most of them are just really, really stupid, and some of them are racist and they're kind of awful. Tanya Grotter stands out. One, the writer, Dmitri Mitz, was already an established children's and fantasy writer who I think consciously decided, if I do this, you know, I could make a lot of money and all that. So Tanya Grotter starts out like the first book. This is how these series almost all start up. The first book is like note for note, the first Harry Potter book, like plot beat for plot beat. Tanya Grotter has a magic double bass. She's an orphan. She has a sister, there's a girl instead of Dudley. The parents are, one of the father is a new Russian. That means like a sort of semi-rich guy. But really, and she goes off to a different school, but it's the same sort of stuff. And the villain isn't Voldemort. The villain is the one who isn't, and it's a female villain, whatever. But it's the same stuff, right? And so it is just so obviously ripped off. But then there are 13 other books, and plus another series of 8 books in the same world. So he's really outwritten Harry, outwritten Rowling in terms of quantity. And then also, once the first book is done, he's coming up with his own plots. So it stops being completely derivative and starts being its own world. So there are generations of people who grew up reading both Tanya Grotter and Harry Potter and have really fond memories of Tanya Grotter, not as this confection that was just made for money, but as this part of their childhood. And the books aren't bad. You can find really horrible Google Translate versions online, which are hilariously bad because of how bad the translation is. But you know, they're pretty good. And so there's no point in trying to enforce copyright in Russia. It's just not going to work. But when a translation was commissioned in the Netherlands, that's when the lawyers got in, because even though the Netherlands is a tiny market, the idea was once this starts, Tanya Grotter could be published everywhere, and this is impinging on trademark, and they won, and that was it for translating Tanya Grotter.
So that's why you can only get the horrible Google
Yes,
Translate versions.
that is why you can only get the horrible Google Translate versions. And there are a lot of people who feel that in terms of free speech and copyright, that was a terrible decision. Then, of course, all along, what you have, basically, the attitude towards Harry Potter from people who are skeptical is, this is Western horrible trash, and why don't we have a version of it of our own? Like, why can't we
Yeah, why can't we make this trash?
why can't we make our own trash? Thank you. Like, why do we have to import trash from another country when we can have our own trash that smells Russian? And so everybody's looking for our answer to Harry Potter. That's the formulation here in Russia to like every kind of phenomenon. Our answer to this, our answer to that. So our answer to Harry Potter. And what happens is in 2003 or four, a novel called Kids Versus Wizards is published, supposedly by a Greek guy named Nikos Zervas, who clearly doesn't exist, who supposedly spent time in the Soviet Union, knows Russia pretty well. And actually, it's almost entirely certain that it's a bunch, like probably a group of Russian writers who wrote under the pseudonym, which is fascinating. They could, to make Russia's answer to Harry Potter, they have a Greek. And you know, it's interesting from the point of view of how, you know, their religion comes from Greece, Orthodoxy, but also as a way of kind of having it be like very pro-Russian, very about Russia, but having an outside sort of Western culture say, yes, this is really, really good. Anyway, the book is really, really bad. It's incredibly t it's hilarious. And I included a couple books at different points to make a point, but I feel like I read this entire book. I have to be able to do something with it. So the upshot is that there is a Academy of Wizardry in Scotland, and it has affiliates all throughout the world, and it is seducing children to believe in magic, which is satanic. And the only place that has resisted it is in Russia, because Russia has the Russian Shield. We'll get back to what that is. So a wizard named Leo Rubchinsky. He has an obviously Jewish name for the Russian reader, and he's called Leo because they think anyone named Lev has to be called Leo in Russian in English because of Leo Tolstoy, who's Lev. Whatever. He comes to this school, and he's giving lessons on magic, and it's all part of trying to break the Russian shield. And there are some orphans who were lured into Scotland, Russian orphans, and they need to be rescued. So this Suvorov Military Academy sends a teenager whose name is Ivan, basically he's called Ivan Tsarevich, which is the hero of all Russian folklore, Ivan's son of the Tsar, to lead a team of commandos to go and rescue these children and make sure the Russian shield is not broken. The Russian shield, by the way, is orthodoxy. Orthodox belief is what is saving Russia. By the end, they have a detour through Kosovo. They have a long lecture about the evils of masturbation, which is kind of amazing. And then
that's great for a children's book.
Well, that's exactly what some of the comments are like. Oh my God! Like
it's a cautionary tale
this is for Orthodox kids, and it's talking about jerking off and I'm like, why, right? So hilarious, right? So anyway, by the end, of course, they have won, and it turns out that Harry Potter is actually not Harry Potter. Harry Potter is Hermione's transgender sibling. Because that makes them more evil. And this is the first book in a series, but the rest of the books are not about Harry Potter. They're about the military school. Anyway, so that comes out in 2003, 2004, that gets bad reviews. There's an expose about how it's probably not written by a Greek. And then in 2015, a movie comes out that is very much supported by the Russian Orthodox Church and supported by the government, but not made by the government. And it's supposed to be this huge thing. And it is unbelievably terrible. It's, for one thing, it's an animated film, but the animation is so much worse than the animation of anything that was being done in Russia at the time, where they had good animators. It's like subpar video animation from 2008. And part of it isn't even animated. It's like some soldiers sitting around talking, but their voices are dubbed. It's very strange. It's just so bad that it was immediately declared the worst Russian film of the century. And this is 2015.
Nothing will be worse.
No, nothing
in the next 85 years.
Oh, I know. Well, that's what I said about George W. Bush, and look what was wrong there.
Right, never say never.
Yeah, exactly. But so it's on YouTube with English subtitles. I highly recommend it. And the comments are so hilariously savage, right, about how bad this is. People are just so enjoying tearing this movie apart because it has almost nothing to recommend it.
I think in your talk for the Harry Potter Academic Conference, you said that it was sort of like the Russian Orthodox Church's Sharknado.
Sharknado, yes, Sharknado or Oogie Loves, which almost no one remembers, this terrible subpar Teletubby thing that I was one of like 10 people who saw.
But watchable only because of how bad it is.
It is. Yeah. It's true. And I love it. It has to be just bad enough, but it's so bad, it's just fantastic. But that's the only way to recommend it. It should be a midnight movie where people are throwing popcorn in it and having callbacks. It's that bad. And a lot of money was spent on it. Like there's so much money and so many talented people came together to produce this amazing piece of crap. But that was supposed to be inculcating Orthodox values, Russian patriotism, all of that. And the funny thing is that so much of the criticism of Harry Potter was about how it is a secret plot to undermine Russians by bringing in satanic Western values. That is to undermine Russian values, and this is why it's being done. And you can always find an ideological context to any work and say there's an ideology, but this is like deliberate. And the funny thing is, they're absolutely wrong about Harry Potter, but what they're doing, and this is so typical, is responding with something that is doing exactly what they're accusing their opponents of doing and showing how bad the result is when you're doing that, right? I don't think Harry Potter could have been as good if it were about pushing for this agenda so explicitly. There's no explicit agenda. And this is like, right, pounding on the head again and again and again. And this is why it's such an abject failure, because it is doing what it thinks its enemy is doing, and its enemy is not doing it. And the result is terrible.
It's really fascinating to me. And I always feel like, you know, when something in the official culture tries to replicate or mimic what is going on in a subversive realm, that it never comes across. It's so ham-handed. Yeah. And so I'm also interested in, you know, we had talked earlier about how the Harry Potter phenomenon just coincidentally is in the Putin era almost entirely, but that Putin himself, you know, is kind of connected in with Harry Potter, not only through the Dobby reference, but of course also in referencing him as the Dark Lord, right? As mm-hmm. a kind of Voldemort figure. And so, you know, that sense that it can be tied into a kind of anti-authority or, you know, anti-officials kind of point of view. I'm interested in hearing more from you about the way that people have, you know, used the Harry Potter books in an anti-Putin kind of way, or the Harry Potter vocabulary or something.
Yes, the vocabulary. And it's totally predictable because this is what's happened with, to some extent, with Star Wars and definitely with Lord of the Rings. I wrote about this elsewhere, and I think in the book that since the interpretation of the Lord of the Rings in Russia has been very much that Lord of the Rings is about the Soviet Union and Russia, that they're the orcs and Tolkien was against them, which is just totally like factually wrong, I think, when it comes to this book. Doesn't matter. That's how it's received. But then you have people identify, all right, we're going to be orcs. That's us. We're going to identify with the bad guys. And Ukraine calling Russia Mordor and calling Moscow Mordor and calling the Russian soldiers orcs, right? So you already have that. So of course it's going to happen with Harry Potter. So first you have Dobby. Then you have Putin's refusing to say the name of Alexei Navalny, the opposition leader who died under mysterious circumstances in prison a couple years ago. And he would just refer to him as that blogger who would never say the name. So of course people said, oh, it's basically it's like not saying Voldemort. So that in a sense, Voldemort was attached to Navalny, but only in the sense of he who must not be named.
We talked about how Putin didn't want to be referenced to Dobby. Now, I love Dobby. I think Dobby is a representation of an amazing amount of courage and independence of thought, actually. But it's really done to, I mean, almost like to mock Putin or to
Oh,
suggest
yes.
something childlike and ugly about him, I
Oh, yeah. I
guess.
mean, I remember a protest sign like, somebody give Putin a sock. right? So,
Liberate the man.
If it were only that easy.
if we're only that easy, right? But then also, after a while, as Putin gets older and gets more and more Botoxed, he still does have a nose, but he starts to kind of resemble the cinematic Voldemort. And so it's very easy then to plug him into the Voldemort image. Ukraine, there's lots of Ukrainian stuff that does that. There's this amazing mural in Poland. It becomes quite simple to represent Russia as the Death Eaters and Putin as Voldemort. And people understand that immediately.
Yeah, I
So it
think
works
you
very
had
well.
talked about that mural in your talk where you showed it. I took a screenshot because I was like, this is cool. I want to show this at some point. But that it has Zelensky in very Harry Potter-like depiction. And
With
instead
the
of the,
scar.
yeah, instead of the lightning scar, it's a Z, right?
Yes.
And then it then Putin is obviously, he's on the other half of the mural. And it's obviously Putin, but it's also obviously Voldemort at the same time.
Exactly.
Yeah,
Very easy to do.
powerful. And you said it immediately like becomes a meme.
Yes, it
Yeah, and
does.
that's what makes it actually even more powerful.
No question. It's kind of unavoidable. It's and really, really, I think, predictable.
Yeah, and I guess the government has tried to crack down on some of those things. I mean, you talked about how, the Soviet, not Soviet Union, but like post-Soviet Union, Russia had to make some laws that would prevent people from saying what they really think and criticizing the government, and also the Orthodox Church. And so, you talked about laws against hurting people's religious feelings and also laws that against making fun of people in positions of authority.
Exactly. This is third term Putin and later. That's after 2012. Because for for 20 years, there is, with some important exceptions, real free speech, right? And there's very little internet censorship. And now we're at the point where people can be imprisoned for liking something on Facebook. Well, actually, there's not Facebook, but liking something on social media. And of course, it doesn't mean that everybody's going to be, but you never know who is going to be. So at this point, I mean, I've always been very frustrated by this really simplistic Western characterization of the Soviet Union and of Russia as like a place where, oh, you have no freedom, you can't say what you want to say, this horrible like stereotype. But it's kind of become that at this point, finally, right? It really has become so repressive that you can be arrested for standing on the street holding up no sign, right? Just as if you're holding up a sign, then you're already can be arrested. So it's not fighting the Harry Potter memes specifically. It's fighting everything, every kind of criticism. And that just got worse and worse and worse from 2012 on until now we're at the point where you really have to be afraid about just about anything you might want to say.
Yeah, this reminds me so much of Vaclav Havel. I just taught 20th century
Oh,
Europe, and
yeah.
I always have my students read the essay, The Power of the Powerless. And one of the things he talks about is literally signs, and that when you put up the sign in the window, Workers of the World Unite, you're just saying, I'm afraid, please leave me alone.
Yes.
But like the idea that it doesn't even matter what your sign says, it doesn't matter if you don't put anything up, just the not putting up of the sign is a problem. And you talked about in your book how Harry is often likened to like the boy in the Emperor's New Clothes story, which is referenced in Václav Havel as well, who says, you know, the emperor's naked, and points out that the authority, you know, doesn't really have the amount of power or sophistication or whatever that it's putting on, and that in itself is, you know, is really dangerous for the state.
Yeah. The emperor has no nose. Right.
Right.
Just the notion that like one person or small group of people can overthrow everything is subversive in its way. Right. And also not necessarily historically accurate for Russia. So, there are ways in which it ends up feeling very much like it's from somewhere else.
And this is kind of where you leave the book. And actually, whenever I teach to my 20th century Europe class, it used to be called Contemporary Europe. And then I was like, it's like been 25 more years of history since I started teaching the class. And I just can't keep adding all of that. But I always tell the students that like the first decade or so I was teaching it, the class always ended on a different note, because I don't teach it every year, right? So I could end it on a positive note, and then like, 2008 happened. It was a negative note, right? And then things get better.
Yes.
And then it's, you know, Brexit. And right. And then you got Vladimir Putin to talk about as well. And so I just feel like, you know, you talk about this in the book, that the idea that everything is getting progressively better, right? The arc of the universe bends towards justice, which you hear a lot in American, not only like political rhetoric, but also in the way people talk about American history, right? That things are always getting better, but that Russia and Russian people don't necessarily have that same experience in terms of their history and what they've experienced even within people's lifetimes. And so your final chapter in the book is, your conclusion is, the cruel optimism of the wizarding world. What do you mean by that? And how can we think about that not only in a Russian context, but maybe a global context?
So optimism is something that one doesn't necessarily associate that much with Russian culture and Russian history. I mean, just enough, under Stalin, there was like a very official optimism. Everybody's supposed to be happy, 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 and things are getting better. There's been very little to be optimistic about since 1991. Reform did not lead to many people's lives getting that much better. But you do have this moment in 2011, 2012 with the protest movement, when people are turning out in the streets and having their like hilarious signs and making fun of people in power. And it seems like, well, maybe now things could be different. And then it didn't happen, and it all gets crushed, right? So in recent memory, you have a moment of a little bit of optimism, and it is just flattened, right? Which then goes back to encouraging you to say, oh, that's how it always happens in Russia. It's always going to be bad. I'm not saying it's always going to be bad, but it's an easy narrative to fall into for some good reasons, right? So if you are that generation and you grew up reading Harry Potter and all these other Western escapist things where, you know, the good triumphs over evil and just the plucky heroes can get what they want and can win, your own experience as something very, very different. What I was talking about in that last chapter was this moment during COVID when the front man of this group called Spleen issued released a song on YouTube that says, pass this along to Harry Potter if you happen to see him. And it's a song, basically he's singing to Harry Potter about, you know, how bad things have gotten, and we wish you could come help, but we know you're over there in your England and you're never going to come help us. So we have to help ourselves, right? And then the founder of the first big Russian rock group from the early 60s, Time Machine, he gives a response on YouTube. And then all of these people do their own versions of the song on YouTube, some of which you'll imagine Harry Potter is writing to Pinocchio, whatever, all these other things. But it becomes this dialogue about how we really can't expect this sort of outcome in Russia, or we can't rely on anyone but ourselves. There's a more positive possible spin on it. But I think what I meant by the cruel optimism, and of course I'm borrowing from Laurie Berlant here, but in a different context, is that we have these stories that encourage us to think that yes, good will triumph, when there's not always a reason to believe in it. And I'm not saying that then you should have stories of which for your children in which good fails again and again and again. I mean, I used to joke that the video Sing and Dance with the Teletubbies in Russian should be Suffer and Endure with the Teletubbies, more culturally appropriate. But the upshot is that life doesn't turn out the way. And of course, life doesn't turn out the way for most people, but so obviously doesn't turn out that way in Russia, that that it's not so much in this reading, it's not so much about some plot against Russia or some conspiracy, some that the values are here to undermine us, but in fact that the values are really good ones, but they're not going to work here. And that's really sad. We're not going to defeat Voldemort.
You know, it's one of the things that in the United States we're also confronting. There are a lot of people who are who've become very cynical, and you know, they're just like, I'm just going to keep my head down because there's nothing that we do will work, and all this, you know, protesting in the streets, that doesn't really do anything, and you know, just more bad things just keep happening. But that people have been making the argument that cynicism actually works toward your opponents, and a kind of irrational hope is actually the best tool that you have if you're
Probably.
trying to achieve something better. Although, you know, I think in the United States we haven't had as long a, you know, period of disappointment.
Not that sort of disappointment, but in fact, the cynicism, apolitical culture is exactly what facilitated the rise of Putinism in Russia. That, people, for very good and obvious reasons, they just wanted to be left alone when it came to politics. Just and the it's phrased you hear again and again, "Tutti just no, let's not talk about politics," which you can understand. But what that means is, okay, politics is someone else's stuff, and the kind of grand bargain Putin had with the populace in the first 10 years or so, let us handle all the big stuff, and you guys can have decent lives. Right, you can go to IKEA. You can buy stuff. You can go on vacation. The economy is getting better because of oil prices. So you leave us alone, we leave you alone. And so there's no room for being involved in politics. And then you close your eyes to the bad things that are happening. And now a lot of people associated with Russia are pointing to that and saying, this is one of the big mistakes we made, that we retreated from politics, and our retreat from politics played into the hands of Putin. Why is it that in Ukraine they were able to overthrow their dictator and we were not, right? And we just decided politics wasn't about us, and that is where our biggest mistake was. And so now at this point, yeah, it's very unclear like where there's room to express your politics now, but the point is that you should have been expressing them all along. So it is an object lesson of how cynicism is not helpful, and we are not at a point in the United States where we have to be that afraid. And so we shouldn't be that afraid, because we shouldn't let that fear, those of us who are going to be deported by ICE, we
But
shouldn't
otherwise,
let that.
use your rights. I always say to my
Yeah,
students,
use
use
your
your privilege.
privilege.
Rights.
Yeah,
Use
you still
them.
have them.
This is all reminding me of the scene in Deathly Hallows when they're in Aberforth's bar and he opens up the portrait. And in comes Neville Longbottom, and he's beat up. I mean, he's not looking good. You know, he's been fighting the fight. You know, he has been in the mix,
Yeah.
using his privilege, using his pure blood, because he knows they're not going to kill him, because he's pure blood, and he's using that. And he comes in, and he's just like, "Well, we've won now because Harry and friends are back." You know, like he's like, it's not as simple as that, of course, but he's like got all the hope that everyone needs,
And
to like
that's
fight the
after
fight.
Aberforth has given his big speech about how
Yes.
nothing's going to change. What do you think? And Dumbledore didn't even leave you any tools, did he?
Right. And so the narrative turns us around from that and
Yes.
says, no, follow Neville. I think there needs to be a new cultural movement of people writing letters to Neville.
To Neville, absolutely. Well, and especially now that
That is
Neville's,
my request.
and now that he's gotten so hot, right? I mean, it's much easier.
Yeah.
Totally.
Neville has
Pass this
abs.
to Neville Longbottom when you see him.
Yeah, exactly.
So
Be
our
a poster.
final question here is the sort of big question about, can this fantasy literature and the transmedia cultural movement, can it actually play a role in liberating people from authoritarian regimes? What do you think, Elliot? I mean, it's a big question.
I think it can if people want it to, because what I mean, I think what decades of cultural studies and media studies have shown us, and literary studies, is that you cannot predict people's readings of a text, right? And so you look at Harry Potter, you look at Star Wars, look at Lord of the Rings, and you feel like you've got a pretty clear set of messages. But people might be taking different messages from it. The fact that there are people who watch The Boys and think Homelander is the hero is kind of amazing. The ways in which the Silicon Valley bros are interpreting Tolkien, and Palantir, and all of that, right? That you can misread however you want. But these texts have enough in them that if you're not predisposed to misread in this particularly politically oppositional way to the text. I think it's less that this makes you, for the first time, think about some sort of liberatory framework, but it is an encouragement, something to make you feel better about it, and also encouraging you to go out and talk to other people, right? Because here's where I think that the fantasy has so much power, because fantasy builds community. Fandoms are communities. What we need most of all is to be talking to each other and getting together. And fantasy fandoms give us a reason to do that. And most of them, if you're not reading against them, are also reinforcing a narrative of liberation. So it's a choice we make that the narratives make very possible for us, but we still have to make the choice.
I love that. I think that's a perfect note to end on. What about you, Emily?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Well, thank you so much, Elliot, for being on our show today.
Oh, thank you. I've really enjoyed it. I really appreciate you inviting me.
Wow, this has been a fabulous conversation. I love all this stuff so much. As a cultural historian, I just believe so firmly in the power of culture, and I loved what you said there at the end. And so our closing quote, thank you so much for setting that up unknowingly, Elliot. Our closing quote comes from The Goblet of Fire, when Dumbledore says, "Lord Voldemort's gift for spreading discord and enmity is very great. We can fight it only by showing an equally strong bond of friendship and trust."
That's great.
Until next time, class dismissed. We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review. And be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook and Instagram. Potterversity is produced by Laurie Beckoff and edited by Lan Deer. Our announcer is Sarah Brown. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Ellsburn, Scott Hacker, Travis Prinzi, Ashley Shepard, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Ellsburn.